Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
Golden State Warriors beat the Cleveland Cavaliers 129-120 to win the NBA title. By Janie McCauley, AP, Oakland, California. Kevin Durant capped his spectacular first season with the Warriors by bringing home that coveted NBA championship he joined Golden State last July so determined to get, scoring 39 points in a fast and furious finals-clinching 129-120 victory over LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers on Monday night. Stephen Curry added 34 points, 10 assists, and 6 rebounds as Golden State closed out its second title in 3 years after squandering a 3-1 lead a year ago to the Cavs to miss a repeat. That stung ever since. And even Durant understood because he gave up the same lead to the Warriors a round earlier with Oklahoma City. "We learned from everything we've been through," Curry said during the trophy celebration. "Our perspective, being blessed to play on this stage 3 years in a row, it's for these fans, for our organization, for these families. To be back here, bring old Larry back home. I'm just excited to do something special. I'm ready to do it again." James, who in 2012 with Miami beat the Thunder in Durant's only other finals, wound up with 41 points, 13 rebounds, and 8 assists. Kyrie Irving followed up his 40-point gem in Friday's Game 4 with 26 points, but shot 9 for 22. This time, King James gave way to KD, who was the NBA Finals MVP, 10 years after being picked second in the NBA draft behind Greg Oden. "It's just a great group of guys, great community, great arena, great fans," Durant said. "I'm just so happy to be a part of it. I can't wait to celebrate with my teammates in the locker room." Durant drove left, right, and down the middle, knocked down three-pointers, dished and dunked. He knocked down a 17-foot fadeaway over James earlier in the fourth quarter, then assisted on a three-pointer by Andre Iguodala the next time down as the Warriors pulled away. Iguodala, the 2015 Finals MVP, came up big again with his 2017 postseason best, 20 points off the bench, and stingy defense on James in a testy, tightly called finale to this trilogy finals that everyone had stamped on the calendar from the moment Durant departed Oklahoma City to join Curry and company. The Warriors won in 2015 before the Cavs made their historic comeback last year. Then it was Golden State's time again, with Durant as the prized addition. Durant shot 14 for 20, and Curry, the two-time reigning MVP who took a back seat as the new big star got acclimated, finished off a brilliant postseason, not to mention a healthy one after his 2016 injuries. Draymond Green stayed on the court in a game that featured three technicals on one play, 3 minutes and 8 seconds before halftime. David West fought for the ball with Irving, then they got tangled up, and Tristan Thompson entered the fray, and he and West went at each other face to face. West, Thompson, and J.R. Smith received texts after a replay review. Green had sat out this very game a year ago, suspended because of flagrant foul point accumulation after he swiped at James' groin in Game 4. He had 10 points, 12 rebounds, and 5 assists in the clincher. With a much-improved bench led by Iguodala, JaVale McGee, Sean Livingston, and West, that strength in numbers slogan that has become such a staple the past two seasons shined all season long. From Durant's 19-game absence late in the regular season with a left knee injury to assistant coach Mike Brown stepping in for 11 postseason games to lead the way while Steve Kerr was ailing. On Monday, Golden State used a 27-4 second-quarter run to take charge, just after it appeared Durant should have been called for a third foul on a basket by James, and got to celebrate right at home in Oakland, surrounded by a deafening home crowd, waving yellow rally towels and holding up phones to shoot video and photos as the final minute of the clock ticked away. The buzzer sounded and gold confetti began to fall. The Warriors became the first Bay Area team to capture a championship at home since the A's finished the Los Angeles Dodgers in Game 5 of the 1974 World Series. A year ago, these Warriors fell short after a record-setting season that included a 24-0 start and 73 victories at the end to break the 1995-96 Chicago Bulls wins.
France's Emmanuel Macron reaps the benefits of being the anti-Trump, by Vivian Walt in Paris. It was just a 6-second video clip, but it signaled a coming out of sorts. In Brussels in late May, France's brand new president, Emmanuel Macron, engaged in a white-knuckle hand grip with President Donald Trump in a gesture that the French leader admitted he had carefully planned in order to signal to Trump he would not be messed with. "You have to show you will not give little concessions," Macron explained to a French journalist afterwards. The French, and indeed all of Europe, lapped it up, reveling in the sight of the fresh-faced leader, just 39, making his debut on the world stage, standing up to a U.S. president nearly twice his age and deeply disliked in Europe. And on Sunday, voters rewarded Macron's year-old political movement, Republic Onwards, with a landslide victory in first-round parliamentary elections, almost ensuring that Macron will enjoy an overwhelming majority in the National Assembly after next Sunday's runoff vote, according to the polling company Ipsos. In the process, Macron has all but obliterated the traditional political parties that have dominated politics in France for about 50 years, including the Socialist Party that governed the country until last month, and that on Sunday won a minuscule 7.4% of the votes. The achievement has stunned political veterans who liken it to a political revolution. "France is back," declared the Macron-appointed Prime Minister Edouard Philippe on Sunday night. Several factors have powered Macron's sweeping victories, among them a seething frustration shared by millions of French over economic stagnation and years of double-digit unemployment, and a belief that drastic change is necessary to solve the country's problems. But as Macron absorbs his astonishing success, he owes thanks, too, to President Donald Trump. After just a few weeks in the palace, Macron is rapidly emerging as one of the clearest global counterpoints to Trump, catapulting him into a role that he never envisaged for himself, not even pursued as a candidate. When he launched his improbable run for president in September last year, he focused his campaign squarely on domestic issues of taxes and jobs. Those issues are still crucial for Macron, who is seeking to overhaul the country's hidebound labor laws and steep taxes. But as president, he's seeking to position himself as the world's anti-Trump on issues from globalization and the environment to human rights. It's a move that brings short-term benefits but carries long-term risks. The schism between the Parisian and the New Yorker exploded to the surface at last month's NATO summit in Brussels and the G7 summit in Sicily, where Trump scolded leaders for too low defense spending and hinted he would cancel the U.S. commitment to the global climate change treaty known as the Paris Agreement. When Trump returned to the White House and announced he was doing just that, Macron pounced. Within hours, he released a video in which he told Trump in perfect English there was no Plan B because there is no Planet B, an appeal to U.S. climate researchers to move to France and take advantage of generous state-funded research projects. "Make our planet great again," Macron said, turning Trump's campaign slogan into a verbal slingshot against him. The following day, Macron launched the slogan as a new website in an effort to persuade disaffected, high-skilled Americans to move to France. The French president has also seized upon the opportunity afforded by Trump's isolationism in a round of high-profile meetings with foreign leaders. Only weeks into his first term, Macron has already met with the leaders of India, China, and Russia.
In a press conference with President Vladimir Putin at the Palace of Versailles on May 31st, Macron accused Russia's state-funded media of lying propaganda and demanded the whole truth about the murder of gays in Chechnya. He also inaugurated a counterterrorism center last week, aiming to turn France into a powerhouse for global intelligence. Trump, meanwhile, helped open a similar center in Saudi Arabia, effectively outsourcing the fight against extremism to Arab allies. Macron, by contrast, made it clear the fight must begin at home. "Nature abhors emptiness," said Dominique Moisy, senior counselor at the Montaigne Institute in Paris, which has close ties to members of Macron's team. "Suddenly, the torch of universalism and multilateralism is handed to Macron's France," Moisy says. "France is playing the card that used to be the American card." In France, that strategy is highly appealing politically. Just as it helped EU leaders to show close friendship with former President Barack Obama, who still enjoys huge popularity in Europe, so it is helping them to stand up to Trump. "It is very useful in terms of domestic politics," says Jeremy Shapiro, director of research at the European Council on Foreign Relations in London. "Trump is less popular than Satan in Europe." Yet Macron could find that tactic backfire. Europe has long-standing ties with the U.S. that go deeper than the relationship between two diametrically opposed presidents. France, for example, still depends heavily on U.S. cooperation in military conflicts in Mali and the Central African Republic. There is this hope in the EU that is widespread, that Trump is all bluster, and that it does not matter that Trump is president of the U.S., and that there are plenty of grown-ups in Washington who can contain him, says Shapiro, who has previously worked in the U.S. State Department. "That hope is misguided," Shapiro says, "and that EU leaders like Macron are ill-prepared for how their open antagonism to Trump could cause problems at moments of crisis. It really does matter who the president of the U.S. is," he says. After Trump announced he would pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement on climate change, some political analysts wondered whether he had done so partly because of having been disrespected in Europe by EU leaders. One report by the Washington Post said that handshake irritated and bewildered Trump and may indeed have played a factor in his decision to quit the agreement. What happens if another crisis strikes, a terrorist attack, for example, or even a war, and Macron and other EU leaders need U.S. help? This easily slighted president might not be so inclined to give it. "Trump is a volatile character with a lot of power," says Shapiro. "They had better understand the implications of this and plan for it, and right now, I do not think they are." Now that he is on the verge of a comfortable majority in Parliament, France's Wunderkind might need to figure out a way to shake hands with his U.S. counterpart over their differences and move on.
Dennis Rodman returns to North Korea for a third round of Basketball Diplomacy by Charlie Campbell in Beijing. The worm has returned. On Tuesday, former NBA great Dennis Rodman flew back to North Korea during a time of heightened tensions with Washington after the rogue state's 16 missile tests so far this year and its arrest of two more U.S. citizens, bringing the total number of Americans held by the regime to four. It's the third trip to North Korea for Rodman, who was previously hosted in 2013 and 2014 by Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un, a known basketball fanatic. The 56-year-old New Jersey native, who helped win two NBA championships for the Detroit Pistons and three for the Chicago Bulls, is one of a tiny number of Americans to have met Kim and calls the dictator a friend for life. However, his visits have been controversial given the regime's record of human rights abuses that amount to crimes against humanity, according to a 2014 UN report, and its frequent threats to launch nuclear strikes against the U.S. and her allies. Speaking to CNN at Beijing Airport before boarding his flight to Pyongyang, Rodman said he was pretty sure U.S. President Donald Trump was happy that "I'm over here trying to accomplish something that we both need." He said that he was trying to open doors, though when asked about possibly helping American detainees, said, "That's not my purpose right now." Accompanying Rodman was Columbia University geneticist Professor Joe Terwilliger, who joined Rodman's 2014 visit to Pyongyang. In July 2013, Terwilliger taught for 3 weeks at the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, founded by Korean-American Kim Chin-kyung, where two American academics were arrested in April and May, respectively. Sources close to Rodman told Time that the visit would likely last until the weekend. Senior U.S. diplomats in South Korea confessed to having no knowledge of the trip, while the State Department said it was aware but stressed the visit was unofficial. Dennis is not a diplomat or scholar of international affairs or security or diplomacy, so people should not have that expectation of him, says Daniel Pinkston, an East Asia expert at Troy University in South Korea, who advised Rodman personally during his previous trips to North Korea. But he's very kind-hearted and generous and means well. He only wants what's best. Rodman's assertion that Trump would approve of a new round of basketball diplomacy seems at odds with the extra pressure Washington has piled on the regime following its escalating nuclear and missile tests. In April, Trump dispatched the USS Carl Vinson strike group to the Korean Peninsula and subsequently warned of a possible major conflict with North Korea. The UK Financial Times reported that former U.S. President Jimmy Carter had been specifically asked not to get involved in negotiations. But it's possible that Trump is changing tactics. The president has described Kim as a maniac and madman, while incongruously praising him for holding on to power despite his young age, calling him a pretty smart cookie and saying he would be honored to meet him. Before assuming office, Trump had praised Rodman's trips to North Korea and during his campaign talked of sitting down with Kim for a hamburger. U.S. officials in Seoul have previously told Time that the release of U.S. citizens Otto Warmbier, Kim Dong-chul, Kim Sang-duk, and Kim Hak-song, who are being held on various charges including espionage and committing hostile acts, could be used as an olive branch. Stephen Haggard, professor of Korea-Pacific Studies at UCLA San Diego, says that Rodman certainly didn't act in any official capacity under former President Barack Obama. But with this administration, who knows, he adds. You can't rule it out. Certainly, Rodman is on personal terms with Trump, having twice appeared on The Celebrity Apprentice, and in March said he was willing to negotiate on behalf of Trump with Kim. Rodman's visit also changes the tenor of bilateral relations from the increasingly belligerent to somewhat more cordial. In that respect, it releases diplomatic pressure on the Kim regime at a time when Beijing has been squeezing the North Korean economy, which relies on China for around 90% of its trade. South Korea's new president, Moon Jae-in, was also elected on promises of measured re-engagement with the Kim regime. There are likely also personal reasons for Kim wanting Rodman to return, given how utterly isolated the 33-year-old leader appears at the summit of the third-generation Stalinist dynasty, having already ordered the execution of his powerful uncle, Jang Song-taek, and also likely his estranged half-brother, Kim Jong-nam. One source with inside knowledge of Rodman's previous trips told Time the visits consisted of one long party of boozing. In a dictatorship, no one can trust anyone, even with the extraordinary powers that Kim has, says Pinkston. He can enjoy a luxurious life and everything else, which Kim does. But in terms of personal relationships and trust, that's almost impossible to obtain. And Dennis is very kind-hearted and genuine. Attributes that perhaps could be turned to help his countrymen in need.
Why you need to listen to Nancy, a radically honest podcast on LGBTQ issues by Eliana Dochterman. The first season of Nancy, a new podcast from WNYC, doesn't hesitate to get personal. The first episode began with hosts Tobin Lowe and Kathy Tu interviewing their respective parents about their radically different experiences coming out to their families. The pilot set the stage for a series of emotional stories shared by the hosts and guests about the LGBTQ experience, from unpacking what it means to be a gay Republican to a conversation between an older and younger man about their HIV diagnoses to heated arguments over Dumbledore's sexuality. The most recent episode, which dropped Sunday, may be the most emotional yet. For the one-year anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, which left 49 people dead, Lo and Tu traveled to Florida to talk to people affected by the shooting, literally or emotionally, and reflect on how the community has responded and recuperated since the attack. Time spoke to Lo and Tu about the episode, the pressure of becoming leading voices on LGBTQ issues, and the surprising feedback they've gotten from their listeners. Time, you say at the end of your preview episode, "By the way, we're both Asian. You thought you were listening to white people this whole time. That's on you." Were listener assumptions about your race an issue working in the audio world, and how did you decide to address it? Lo, I think that the joke came off as light and breezy, but there was a real intentionality about it, too. There's an expectation that people of color in the media will just talk about what's hard about being underrepresented. And that line was supposed to be like, "That's going to be a thing when I say it's a thing. We're going to share our lived experiences instead of talking about what's hard all the time." Two, it's the same thing being a queer person. Lo, it's about the experience of living as a queer person and not about the idea of queerness. In the first episode, you each interviewed your parents about your experiences coming out to them. How did it feel to share such a personal story in such a public way? Two, well, I only share personal stories on this podcast. I joked the other day, "Okay, for season two, what emotional journeys do you guys want me to go on?" When I hear somebody be vulnerable on a podcast, it reaches me in a way that somebody face-to-face telling me wouldn't have the same impact. So for me, it's not a difficult thing. It's more the people that I pull into these emotional journeys and whether or not they want to go on this trip with me. With my mom, I told her what I was doing, but I think she's still confused about what a podcast is. I did eventually show her the episode. She was like, "Ugh, I don't like the way my voice sounds," which everybody says. And then she was like, "I stand by what I say." So she didn't have any objections to being recorded, which I was actually surprised by. But I did tell her it was for work, and she's always been on board with anything that's work or school related. Lo, when we started the first episode with both of us sharing very personal stories, it sort of lays the gauntlet down for other people to also share their stories because we've done it and it's a space for that. In your most recent episode, you say that you've learned about leadership working on this podcast. Heading into this podcast, did you initially think of yourselves as leaders or representatives of the LGBTQ community? Lo, no, truly not. I think we've come to think of ourselves as proxies. People listen to the show and experience it through our reactions, but we're not experts. Two, even in our roles as proxies, we have specific experiences. Tobin, you're a gay person of color, and I'm a person of color who is, I should say, bi. It's complicated. But we're limited by our own prejudices and biases, so we can only be proxies for so much stuff. That's why it's important to get other voices on the show. But then there are so few podcasts like yours that people want their stories told through it. Lo, right, I think it's a representation thing. A show like Master of None comes to mind. So few, if any, people of color have gotten to write and lead their own series that many people haven't seen people like themselves on TV. So then you wind up putting all your hopes and expectations on this one show. And I think that's natural. Our intention is to be as empathetic as possible, and part of our responsibility is to receive critique and think about things in different ways. Two, it's hard to be seen as individual when there's not enough other people around, so we end up being a monolith without trying to be. What have you learned from listeners? Two, for the episode where we did a mailbag and interviewed actor and author Mara Wilson, we went back and forth about which part should come first. We decided it made sense structurally to talk about the letters we've received, including people saying, "Let's talk about bisexuality," and using that to jump into the interview with Mara, who identifies as bisexual. I got a few pieces of feedback that suggested we made bisexuality an afterthought, just a piece of mail or something. So that makes me think about how we structure our episodes. If we're going to tackle a big topic like bisexuality, I wouldn't put it in the context of mailbag again. Low. And we should say we had booked that interview months in advance. When someone reaches out with a really thoughtful critique, I'm really touched by that because they really listened and understood what we're trying to do, which is learn and continue the conversation. Is your audience who you expected them to be? Low. There was an email that said, "I'm a 55-year-old, cisgendered white man, and I love your show." And that's kind of like, "We were not expecting you, sir, but welcome. Thank you for showing up." Early on, we did a lot of thinking about it, and we actually even made a fake profile of who our ideal listener was. But we got to this point where we realized, ultimately, we were just describing ourselves. And so then the question becomes, what would I listen to? And then I think the purpose of an editor outside of that or other voices is for people then to come in and say, if you want to broaden it out, you might explain this term. Right, you'll often pause to explain why you're using one term or another or what it means. I assume that's for the broader audience. Two, I like to think of it as not so much that we're explaining things for a straight audience, but there's a lot of stuff that we don't know about each other within the community. There was a segment that we did once that we killed, where we were quizzing each other on terms within the gay community, and I got all of them wrong, I think. Low, because they were all gay men terms. Two, yeah, exactly. So when we explain things, I tend to think about it as, we're not explaining for straight people, we're explaining it for ourselves to make it clear what we're talking about. How did you decide you wanted to do an episode for the anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shooting? Low, when Pulse happened, it wasn't clear yet whether we were going to make Nancy, but I had such a strong feeling of, I wish we had the show now. There was a lot of reporting around Pulse last year. How did you decide what you wanted to do going back a year later that would be different? Two, we wanted to spend a week there and basically see how people were dealing with the aftermath and how people were recovering. You said this a few times, Tobin, but when we talked to them, it seemed like it was the first time they actually sat down and processed what they were feeling. The podcast has covered some very serious topics and more lighthearted topics. How do you think about the tone of the podcast and how this episode fits in with the rest of the season? Two, I feel like it's kind of a special episode. We don't start off funny, some conversation between the two of us. We make it very much about Orlando and the people there. Low, sometimes we talk about an episode of Nancy as having this emotional thing of you laugh, you cry, you laugh. And maybe that's the prototype of a Nancy episode. But then I think that's also true of the larger season. And it's important to recognize when it's appropriate for Kathy and I to step back. We did that with the HIV episode. We're basically not in that episode because it's about those two men and their experiences. And I think similar to this episode, we're there enough to hold your hand through it, but it's not really about us. Almost 30% of people in the world are obese or overweight. By Alexandra Sifferlin. The global obesity epidemic continues, and a new report shows that about 2 billion people worldwide are overweight or obese. That's about 30% of the world's population. The new study, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, found that about a third of the global population, including adults and children, exceed a healthy weight. About 10% of people in the world are obese, according to the findings. Studies have linked overweight and obesity to a higher risk for health complications like type 2 diabetes, heart disease, depression, respiratory problems, major cancers, and more. The study authors looked at data from people in 195 countries and territories from 1980 through 2015. They found that in 2015, there were 107 million children and 603 million adults with obesity. Having a high body mass index accounted for 4 million deaths in 2015, and more than two-thirds of these deaths were from heart disease. Since 1980, obesity rates in 70 countries have doubled, the study found, and the rate of childhood obesity has increased faster in many countries than the adult obesity rate. As Time recently reported, several factors have contributed to the growing obesity epidemic, including greater access to fast food, larger portion sizes, and ubiquitous processed food. Emerging science also suggests that chemicals from food and household products may have an effect. 10 Industries Hiring Like Crazy This Summer by Lisa Marie Segarra. While summer is approaching rapidly, the summer job season has already taken off. Job hunting website Indeed on Thursday released findings from its hiring lab on summer job postings, revealing which industries are hiring the most this summer. Although school is out for the summer, the education field offered the most postings for summer jobs, including teacher, high school, elementary, and art positions. Many jobs also involved taking care of children in the social and recreational services, which ranked second in opportunities. Child care, administrative, sales, hospitality, management, protective services, food, and nurse job sectors also ranked among the top job categories. However, while hospitality came in sixth for overall summer job listings, they had the highest concentration of summer postings among all listings in that field, according to Indeed. Many positions were related to summer activities, such as pool managers, tour guide, camp managers, lifeguards, and park rangers. The top 10, according to Indeed, are number 1, education, number 2, social/recreational service, number 3, child care, number 4, administrative, number 5, sales, number 6, hospitality, number 7, management, number 8, protective, number 9, food, and number 10, medical nurse. Indeed's findings looked at job postings with the word summer, excluding internships, from January 1st to June 1st, 2017.
What Trump's Rust Belt Supporters Need to Know This Week by Chris Liu. This week, the Trump administration will try once again to focus its policy agenda around a single theme. With an erratic chief executive and rapidly changing news developments, that's easier said than done. Last week was supposed to be Infrastructure Week. Instead, the week veered wildly off course as the nation was riveted by the FBI director's testimony that the president was a liar and had possibly committed obstruction of justice. Take two. The White House has dubbed this week as Workforce Development Week, with the focus on anodyne issues like vocational training and apprenticeships. Almost as soon as this week was officially designated, it was upended by the announcement that Attorney General Jeff Sessions would publicly testify on Tuesday about the growing Russia investigation. But let's humor the White House for a minute and focus on the president's choice of themes, workforce development. During the presidential campaign, Donald Trump appealed to working-class voters by promising to bring jobs back to the United States. This populist message resonated in economically struggling areas and allowed him to carry traditionally blue states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Trump will travel to Waukesha County Technical College in Wisconsin to highlight his administration's commitment to training workers. He will likely make a few forced references to The Apprentice and then bash Democrats for obstructing his policy agenda. And then he will conveniently gloss over the fact that his budget slashes 40%, or over $2 billion from federal job training programs. For workers in states like Wisconsin, the impact of these budget cuts would be devastating. Around the country, but especially in hard-hit areas in the Rust Belt, federal training and employment services are a powerful way to provide economic opportunities to millions of unemployed and underemployed adults and young people. Under the Trump budget, an estimated 34,000 Wisconsin residents would lose access to services that help them find work or acquire the skills needed by growing industries like advanced manufacturing, healthcare, and IT. Funding would be slashed to help the over 5,000 Wisconsin workers, many in the manufacturing sector, who become dislocated each year due to plant closings and downsizing. The Trump budget completely eliminates the Senior Community Service Employment Program. In Wisconsin, this program helps 1,000 low-income seniors gain skills and work experience in schools, hospitals, and daycare centers. Importantly, the program gives priority to veterans and people with disabilities, two groups that often struggle with persistent unemployment. Also hurt by the Trump budget are young people who want to contribute to our economy but too often lack the opportunity. The president's budget cuts $350 million from programs targeted at low-income youth, especially those who have dropped out of school. If the budget were to become law, 900 fewer young people in Wisconsin would be able to obtain a degree or certificate, receive career services, or develop job skills through pre-apprenticeship opportunities. In Milwaukee, a program run by the mayor's office has placed over 28,000 teens in summer jobs since 2005. The lives of young people in Milwaukee have been transformed by summer employment, which in turn helps to revitalize neighborhoods. Last summer, 350 young people from the city's poorest communities were able to work because of federal funding that would be endangered by the Trump budget cuts. When Donald Trump announced his candidacy for president in June 2015, he famously pledged to be the greatest jobs president God has ever created. He might be tempted to repeat that pledge when he visits Waukesha County this week, but job creation means nothing without job training programs. During the trip to Wisconsin, Trump will see firsthand how critical job training is for workers climbing the ladder to the middle class. Unfortunately, the president's budget goals make that climb much more difficult for the very people he promised to help.
The 11-minute outdoor workout a fitness guru swears by Stacy Griffith. Now that summer is finally here, I get to combine two of my favorite things, sunshine and a great workout. There's nothing more energizing than starting my day with a sweat session al fresco, as long as I protect my skin with some healthy SPF and stay super hydrated. Here's how to try my summer morning mood lifting routine. Before every outdoor workout, start with a big glass of water and a generous application of your go-to sunscreen. Pick one that won't irritate your skin and be careful not to apply too near your eyes. Have you ever felt the sting of sweat mixed with sunscreen in your eyes? Ouch! Bring the bottle with you to your workout spot so you can reapply as needed. Pro tip, don't forget to protect the backs of your hands. Squirt a small amount of sunscreen on the back of one hand and use the back of the other to wipe it in without getting your palms too slippery. Now you're ready for your outdoor fitness blast. This simple routine is just over 11 minutes long and can be done pretty much anywhere, whether the park, the local track, or a patch of grass outside your house. Always consult your doctor before beginning any new exercise regime and know your limitations. Never compromise your safety. All right, here's the workout. 1 minute, jumping jacks. Take these at an easy warm-up pace. 2 minutes, squats. Step your legs out so they're as wide as your shoulders. Squat down for three counts and back up for one. 2 minutes, jumping jacks. Pick them up to medium pace. 2 minutes, bicycles. For this abdominal blast, lie on your back and crunch up with one elbow reaching toward the opposite knee and reverse. 30 seconds, push-ups. Whether you're in the traditional form or on your knees, take breaks if needed and watch out for your lower back. Keep the power in your chest, abs, biceps, deltoids, and triceps. 3 minutes, jumping jacks, max speed, go. This is your cardio peak. 1 minute, walk slowly to cool down. Stacy Griffith is a senior master instructor at SoulCycle and the author of Two Turns from Zero. Stacy's motivational coaching style combines a passion for dance, athleticism, and mind-blowing music, all set to the beat of her voice. Here's the easiest way to eat more vegetables by Alice Park. Vegetables are the most nutritious and healthy of foods, yet most people don't think they taste as good as burgers dripping with fat or a salty batch of French fries. But what if the same words that food sellers usually reserve for those indulgent foods, like juicy, crispy, and seasoned, were applied to the veggies? Rebranding vegetables as tangy ginger bok choy or sweet sizzling green beans may be just the trick to getting more people to eat them. Researchers at Stanford University put this idea to the test and published their results in JAMA Internal Medicine. For a little over a month, they relabeled the vegetable dishes at a university cafeteria. Each day, the vegetables got one of four types of labels: basic like beets, corn, and green beans, one that highlighted the vegetable's health benefits like vitamin-rich corn, antioxidant-rich butternut squash, one that used more restrictive words in describing the health benefits, reduced sodium corn, for example, or carrots with sugar-free citrus dressing, and one that used indulgent language, the kind typically reserved for unhealthy foods, rich, buttery, roasted sweet corn, dynamite chili and tangy lime-seasoned beets, and twisted citrus-glazed carrots. Despite the changes in labeling, the vegetables were prepared exactly the same way each day. The researchers then discreetly recorded how many people purchased the vegetable as well as the serving size. Turns out that words can launch 1,000 taste buds. 25% more people chose the indulgently described vegetable compared to its basic version, while 41% more chose the indulgently described vegetable over its more restrictive version, and 35% more chose it over the version described with healthy benefits. They ate more of it, too. People served themselves 23% more of the vegetable when it was described with more appetizing language than when it was simply presented with a basic label. The results suggest that words and creative labeling can go a long way toward helping people pile more vegetables on their plates. Making them sound mouth-wateringly irresistible, say the authors, is a pretty low-cost way to get people to load up on veggies. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.